You've got the solution, but your child won't listen. Your spouse won't listen. Your friend won't listen. And you wonder, what's missing? What's wrong here? I know what this person needs to do. I know what the solution is, but they won't listen. You know that you have valuable advice. You know that this advice will help the other person if they will just listen. Why won't they listen? Why don't they seem to care a great deal about what you have to say? Why can't they see that what you are talking about has their best interests at heart? Well, the thing that is often missing is some evidence of compassion, some evidence of your care and concern about the other person. If the other person doesn't really think or doesn't really believe that you care about them as an individual, they frequently won't care too much about what you have to say. No matter how good the advice, no matter how proper, no matter how helpful that advice may be. In this week's installment from the Gospel of John, we are in chapter 5. And we find that in the ministry of Christ Jesus, Jesus showed his compassion to a person, his care, his concern, before he tried to teach critical truth. And that is not only a distinguishing mark of Jesus' ministry, but if you and I care to emulate Christ, to take him as an example, you and I will do the same thing. When we want to minister to somebody, when we want to give somebody truth, regardless of whether that is a spiritual truth or not, but hopefully especially when it is a spiritual truth, we ought to show our compassion first, by words, by actions, and then we are more likely to find a person willing to listen to the truth or the advice that we may have to share. In the text from John that Joan read a little bit earlier, we find this principle, that Jesus showed compassion before he told truth. We specifically find that Jesus first communicated to a man who was an invalid, and he communicated first through compassion, rather than first through trying to tell him some truth. Let's break down that passage into several different sections. Again, we're in John chapter 5, and I want to first read the first 5 verses. And you will notice that not only are the words that I read different than the ones that John read, because this is a different translation, but you notice that there are some words missing, and I'll explain why in just a couple of moments. John chapter 5, verses 1 through 5. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by 5 covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. We're told at the beginning simply that this was an occasion in Jesus' ministry that happened during the time of one of the Jewish feasts. And John didn't consider which feast important. He just said, well, it was the time of one of the feasts and Jesus had gone into Jerusalem. And that just reminds us that Jesus, and this was a bit of his compassion, I think, but his care, his concern, he honored the Jewish festivals, the Jewish feasts. And during one of the times of a feast, he went up to Jerusalem to participate in it. We're told the site of the initial meeting between Jesus and this invalid man is a pool of water in Jerusalem. And depending on what translation of the Bible you have and who you're listening to, it might be pronounced Bethsaida, it might be Bethesda, it might be Bethzatha, and it was an Aramaic name. And that suggests that it probably was around for a lot of years. And it was passed on from generation to generation as a name for this particular pool of water. And in my study, I have come to think that probably the best way to pronounce it is Bethesda. And frankly, that's quite convenient because we have a Bethesda, Maryland, which makes it easy for us to remember the pronunciation. And the word means something which is most important, which kind of gives you a hint as to why the name was used. The word Bethesda literally means house of mercy. And if you're listening as Joan read, what happens sometimes at this pool, Hence the name, House of Mercy, a place where healing sometimes took place. So that was the name. This pool had quite a reputation, it appears. Some of the older translations of the Bible have one or two verses added in. And if you have an older translation of the Bible, you know that when I read, I skipped some of the words that you have. And it appears that these are verses that were added in later years, but they added in a tradition that was very true and very accurate at the time. It seemed that at some times, and there was no routine or no schedule for the times, the water in this pool would begin to bubble up or swirl around. And tradition said that of all those around the pool at that time who had particular diseases or infirmities of some kind, the first one that could get into the water at that time was said to be the one who would be healed of whatever sickness or disease that they had. And of course, if that was true, it's going to gather in people from all over the area. And even if it isn't true, if somebody's had a sickness or a disease for which they've not been able to find a cure, if there's any hope at all, they're going to gather around. So by Jesus' day, regularly, day after day after day, many people would come and sit around or lie around this pool, hoping that it would begin to bubble up or swirl a little bit, and hoping that they could get in, and then hoping, of course, that they would find some healing. Now, some of the translations say that an angel of the Lord came down and stirred the waters, and kind of attributes the healing effect of this pool to God himself. Well, the reality is there probably was some kind of underground spring, and every once in a while it bubbled up or gurgled up, and that's what caused the water to move. But anyway, it had established its reputation, and people gathered around hoping that they could find a cure. John mentions, well, there was one specific man that came to this pool hoping that he could find some healing. We're not given very much detail about him. We don't know his name. All we know is that he's a man who was an invalid, that he had been an invalid for a very long time, 38 years, and he was now coming to this pool day after day after day in hopes that this tradition might be true, or this legend might be true, and that maybe when the waters bubbled, he could get in, and he could find healing, and that he would be able then to get up and to walk around like almost everyone else. Well, one day, Jesus came to this pool. And we pick up this part of the story in verse 6. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. Somehow Jesus learned the details of this man's life. We don't know if it was in conversation with the man himself, which is a possibility, or whether or not Jesus was drawn to this pool because he cares so much about people, and he looked around and he saw the various people and saw their sicknesses and saw their infirmities and just saw that they were, many of them, pretty miserable. And maybe somebody who knew this man told him the story of this man, and Jesus walked over and began a conversation with him. Whatever the case, somehow Jesus learned of this man's condition and learned that he'd been in this condition for 38 years. And either he was a man who was 38 years old and had been like this all his life, or he once was able to walk and get around, and since then, for 38 years, had not been able to walk and had not been able to get around. And we know Jesus well enough to know that his compassion and his concern would be stirred. And he came to the man, and they had some conversation. And we're given only a small glimpse of what that conversation must have been like. We're told that Jesus asked a question, and we're told that Jesus gave a command. Jesus questioned his desire to be healed. And that does seem like a rather strange question. Why would Jesus come to him and say, "Well, do you want to be healed?" We don't know why Jesus asked that question. Maybe Jesus wondered if this man had become comfortable in this procedure of coming to the pool every day. And maybe he found that others felt sorry for him and that they cared for him. And maybe he'd gotten used to that rut or that routine. And maybe he wasn't so sure if he didn't want to be healed. We don't know why Jesus asked the question. But he did ask the question. And the man simply responded by saying, "Well, I want to be healed, but I can't get to the water whenever it's stirred or whenever it bubbles. I can't get around. And while I'm trying to move my way over to the water, somebody else gets in. And I don't have an opportunity to find healing. So obviously this man believed in the legend. He believed in the story. And he told Jesus, I don't have much hope because I just can't get into the water before everybody else gets to it. Possibly the man hoped that Jesus, the next time the waters bubbled, would pick him up and would carry him and would put him in the water. It's obvious, as we read a few more verses in a moment, that this man had no idea who Jesus was. Hadn't the slightest idea. And so he may have hoped that Jesus would help by picking him up and carrying him in. At that point, Jesus took some action that obviously changed this man's life for the rest of his life. Jesus gave him a simple directive. Didn't ask him to do anything particularly unusual, though to him it would have been unusual. He said, stand up. Get up. Pick yourself up off the ground. Reach over, pick up your bedroll or your mat. Put it under your arm and walk away. And somehow the man instantaneously began to get some feeling back in his feet. And he began to know that they were strengthened. And he did get up and he did pick up his bedroll and he did tuck it under his arm. And he did walk away. And this man's life was changed in a most significant way, obviously, for the rest of his life. Now, Jesus wasn't finished with the man at this point. He'd shown him tremendous compassion. And in Jesus' case, he had taken that compassion to the point of doing something physically to help the man. But we've got an interruption here, beginning with the last part of verse 9. The day in which this took place was the Sabbath. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. The man is confronted. And we would expect that the very next words that we see after Jesus healed him were the words, "This happened on the Sabbath." And that ought to be a clue to us that somebody is going to make a case against somebody for having done something wrong on the Sabbath day. And the Jews came to him. And they said, "Well, what's the idea of doing work that's forbidden on the Sabbath?" And we have a hint into the fact that some of God's simple commands were lengthened and a lot of description, a lot of explanation was added. They were upset with the man. And he simply said, probably not thinking that he'd done anything wrong, "Well, there was a man that healed me. He told me to do this. He told me to pick up my mat. He told me to carry it away." And the obvious question on the part of the Jews then is going to be, "Well, who was it? Who said such a blasphemous thing to you? Who did this?" And interestingly enough, Jesus had not yet revealed to this man who he was. And he had no idea. He was unable at that point to reply, "It was Jesus that did this," because he simply did not know. Jesus had shown compassion anonymously and had not yet revealed to this man who he was. But soon the opportunity does come, and Jesus communicates a little bit further with this man. We pick that up in verse 14 of chapter 5. "Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, 'See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you.' The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well." It was only after Jesus had shown compassion to the man and he allowed that to settle for a little while that he began to share some significant truth. He didn't try to convert the man from the very beginning. He tried to show him compassion. He allowed him to experience this compassion, in this case, accompanied by physical healing. Later on, Jesus found the man at the temple. And at that point, he begins to talk about who he is, and he begins to share more communication. And again, all we've got is one simple and few set of words in verse 14. We don't know how the conversation went. We don't know what all Jesus said to this man and what all this man said to Jesus. He certainly had some questions. Now, as time went on, he would have begun to wonder, how in the world did this man heal me? Who is this guy? What's he about? And I'm sure there was a fairly significant conversation that took place. And we have only a few words from that conversation. The words that John did write might be easily understood. Look again at what Jesus said to him. See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. I think Jesus' words not only can, but often have been misunderstood. It might be thought that previously the man had sinned in such a way or to such a degree that what he had suffered in the way of becoming an invalid was a specific punishment for a specific sin. You might infer that from this passage. It might further be thought that Jesus was telling the man, well, if you go out and sin again, you're going to be punished even more severely than you were punished through becoming an invalid. Well, I think those are very poor beliefs. I think those beliefs are very poor theology. They were held to by some in Jesus' day. They had a strong belief that a specific sin would often result in a specific punishment from God. And while that might happen at times, that was not the rule, that was the exception. What is unfortunate is that some today believe this very same thing, that a specific sin is going to lead to a very specific punishment directly from God. And that's very poor theology. It's not what Jesus believed, as two texts now are going to illustrate. There's two other texts I'd like to look at briefly. One is right here in John's Gospel, in chapter 9, just a few pages over. In John chapter 9, in the first three verses, we find this issue addressed very, very specifically. John 9, verses 1 through 3. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. One example to suggest that Jesus did not believe that everything that happened to a person in his day, and we should believe as well for today, but not everything that happened to a person in his day happened specifically because of a sin that somebody committed. If you looked at somebody and saw that they were blind or deaf or lame, it was not because of a specific sin that they had committed or that a previous generation had committed. That was not Jesus' theology. That was not Jesus' belief. Let's look at one more example. In Luke's account of Jesus, in Luke chapter 13, Jesus addresses briefly the same idea or the same subject. Luke chapter 13, again beginning with verse 1, now there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Jesus answered, do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered in this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them. Do you think that they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will perish. So while Jesus, in these various texts, both in Luke and in John, is teaching that there can be punishment because of sin, Jesus does not directly attach a specific punishment to a specific sin. And it was wrong for his disciples to assume that. It was wrong for people in Jesus' day to believe that, and wrong for you and I to believe that as well. We will, and they did in that day, sometimes suffer the consequences of specific sin. But God does not have a chart by which he looks at the chart and says, well, this person did this, and he moves over here and says, well, this is the punishment that they're going to get. That's not the way that God works. That's not proper theology. It's not what Jesus believed, and it certainly is not what Jesus taught. So we move back to John chapter 5, and we wonder then, well, what was this man telling Jesus, or this Jesus telling this man? I would have liked to have seen the rest of the conversation in print. I wonder how the conversation went. It's obvious because in verse 15, the man went and told the Jews that Jesus had done this, that Jesus talked about who he was, that he revealed to this man that he was the Messiah, he was the Christ, he was Jesus. And there were certainly some other things that they talked about as well. John just simply doesn't record that for us. Jesus probably told the man that there were some changes in order in his life, and that was appropriate. Jesus probably told the man that Jesus Christ himself needed to be of higher priority in his life. And Jesus probably told the man, if you reject me and you reject my message, there will be some kind of loss for eternity. There will be a punishment or a result even greater than having been an invalid for 38 years. So Jesus used the man's own experience to teach him a lesson. So Jesus was wanting this man to become a believer. He was wanting this man to experience a conversion in his life. But notice the progression. First, Jesus showed him compassion, in that case illustrated by healing. Only then did Jesus teach significant truth and hope that the man would respond. The man did respond. And then in verse 15, we find that again that he went back to the Jews and he told them that it was Jesus. He gave the credit to Jesus for having made him well. Now, there's a significant way that I believe you and I can apply this Bible text in our lives. And that is simply, in all ways, spiritually related or otherwise, by showing compassion before we give advice. The challenge is, and this is part two of the outline, the application part, how can we balance showing compassion and telling truth? We don't want to ever separate the two. We want to be showing compassion, but we also want to be telling truth. And one should not go without the other. Well, the first thing that I think would be wise for us to do is, number one, observe how people around you seek to solve problems and find meaning in life. Again, think about this invalid man. He spent a lot of time trying to get into this pool called Bethesda. He came day after day, even though it didn't bring any change to his condition, even though he didn't experience any healing, he kept coming, day after day after day. He came to the point that he kept doing this, even though it almost seemed to him, I would think, is a hopeless effort. But he didn't know any better. He didn't know anything else. He kept doing the same thing again and again and again and again, even though he didn't get any results. He apparently didn't believe there were any alternatives. He didn't know what else to do. He didn't know what else to try. He got used to his existence day in and day out. And it might be, I think it's true of people in general, that we get ourselves into habits of doing things, into ways of doing things. And even if we're not getting good results, we get comfortable with doing things a certain way or being a certain way. And it's very difficult for us to change. And it's very difficult for people around us to change. And we ought to observe that and think about that and recognize that. I believe that if you and I will watch people around us, we will observe them living the same kind of an existence that this invalid man was living. They'll do the same things day after day. They'll come to the point where they don't have a lot of hope, but they just keep doing things in the same way, even though they don't get very good results. Hard for them to be convinced there's another way. Some examples, and these are obviously extreme examples to make the point, but I hope that they will make the point. Some people will move from lover to lover to lover, never finding that desired intimacy. They just won't find it, but they'll keep doing the same thing again, move from lover to lover, even though they don't find what they want. Some people will drown their pain in alcohol or some other addiction, even though the pain doesn't go away for more than a short period of time. It becomes the pattern, it becomes the habit. Some people will look for pleasure through more and better material possessions, but they don't ever find satisfaction. But even though there's not a positive result, people tend to keep doing the same thing again and again and again because it's comfortable, because it's common, because it becomes normal for them. And again, those are extreme examples, but I hope that they make the point. Christians are not. when we have pain in our lives, or when we have inappropriate ways of doing things, that becomes part of our life. And it's very difficult for somebody to break through and to reach us and allow us to be changed. So how do we help? How can we help somebody else? Well, I'm convinced that it's a two-step approach, what we've seen Jesus do in this example. And this is number two. The first part is number two in the application. Be ready first with compassion. And be ready first to initiate compassion. I think it is often true, and unfortunately, guys, I think it's more true of us than it is of the ladies. We tend to want to fix the problem. We come to something that's wrong and it doesn't work, we want to fix it. We want to make it right. We want to give the advice that will make things go well for our coworker, or somebody in our family, or for a friend, or even for somebody that we don't know very well. We want to make it right, we want to fix it. We want to solve the problem. And when we do that, we often miss out or forget about the need for compassion that must come first. That was the general pattern that Jesus used. We see the example in today's text. Before he tried to teach significant truth, he showed compassion. He tried to reach the heart. He tried to soften the heart of the person that he had a message for. And then he communicated. We find that in Jesus' ministry in the example of the woman caught in the very act of adultery. Jesus didn't immediately condemn her, but he accepted her. He showed her compassion. And then he followed the compassion with the grain of truth. And if you will do an examination of most of Jesus' instances of healing people, he did this very same thing. He met their need and showed compassion by healing them or feeding them or doing something for them. And then he spoke the truth. He rarely spoke the truth without showing compassion first. And interestingly enough, Jesus rarely showed compassion without also giving some truth. Jesus' example, and I think our pattern, is to first show unconditional acceptance. Whether you want to call it compassion or caring or whatever you want to call it, that comes first. I believe that it is possible for us to do more harm in a person's life by trying to correct them without compassion than to do nothing at all. And repeat that and tell you why. I think it's possible to do more damage in a person's life by trying to correct them without compassion than to do nothing at all. And the reason is if we don't show a person compassion and help them soften their heart and soften their ability to listen to us, and we immediately cram some truth to them, no matter how good that truth is, we are going to probably cause them to become more calloused, and their heart is going to become more protected, and it's going to be harder for compassion to reach through another time. Before we give truth, there needs to be compassion that can soften a heart. I think giving truth without sharing compassion has hurt an awful lot of people. I think a lot of well-meaning individual Christians, as well as a lot of well-meaning churches, have caused a lot of pain and a lot of agony because there's not been as much compassion ahead of time as there should have been. Instead of a stern look, many times we need to give somebody a hug. Instead of a holier-than-thou, see, I told you so, we need to give a listening ear. And if we'll focus on those things, I think we'll find that the last step is going to go a little better, maybe significantly better. There's a simple statement which may be familiar to some of you that I think captures this whole truth as succinctly as possible, and it's easy to remember. The statement goes like this: people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Now, you may have heard that before. I'm going to say it again. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. It's a very simple statement, but I think it's true. I think it's biblical truth. I think it's how Jesus lived his ministry. And if we want to follow him and be his disciples, I think we will practice that in our lives. And so then that leads us to the last point of the sermon outline, which really comes naturally after showing compassion. Once we've shown the compassion, then comes the ability to talk about truth. Truth having to do with biblical principles and truth having to do with Jesus Christ himself. You see, once we have unconditionally accepted somebody, then there is a place for some accountability. There is a place for sharing truth. Because a person knows that they're cared about, that they are looked at as an individual entity, not just as somebody about which you want to cram truth down their throats. I believe that all of us are much more likely to give credence and consideration to the words of another person when they demonstrate to us personal concern. When we know and believe that somebody cares about me, they look at me as an individual person, and I'm valuable to them, I am far more willing to listen to what they have to say. I have observed people being more willing to listen because they have been first unconditionally accepted, because they have first been made to feel as though they are important. I have observed this in children even, particularly at Virginia State Camp, as I and other staff attempt to relate to the kids and hopefully begin to teach the kids some things. Already at that age, late elementary and moving into junior high school, kids don't accept what an adult says or does as an example just because they are an adult. But I noticed particularly during that week, as time is spent building rapport with the kids and getting to know them and treating them as valuable individuals, then the sharing that takes place in terms of truth from adult to child is much more well accepted. I have observed this truth when I've had to confront somebody. I find that if I tend to listen and show respect to the other person, that even if I have something to share with them or say to them that it's been somewhat difficult, they're more willing to listen. But I find that if I jump right into the confrontation, usually a cement wall slips into place and it destroys hope for helpful communication. I know even about myself. When I have been confronted about something, I tend to listen if I sense that the other person respects me. But I tend to shut them down if they talk down to me and if I perceive that they're not showing me respect or care. Only after the other person knows that I care should I offer either an alternative solution to their problem or to suggest that their current way of doing things may not be best, may not be productive, may in fact be destructive. And only then should I also then be able to point to the way or choose to point the way toward Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. It is true that not infrequently you and I do have and do know truth that someone else needs. Particularly that is the case about their need for the truth about Jesus Christ. But sometimes we forget to preface the truth with genuine compassion. Once that compassion tells someone how much we care, then, and often only then, they may care about some truth that we have.